And that's the way he asked us. That people stay in the office. They work over here. They keep us out. The one that it talked for this island. Now Sitka's come over to take it over. Governor says you take the border line off. Let the Admiralty Island be free. That's not the Admiralty Island over here. No. It's Killisrew right here. The Gits Liberia, full of it. This town, this island.
Bear.
Gits Liberia. That's why they call it Hoot on the Woo. The Den. Bear Den.
Bear Den.
That's the name of this island.
Oh. I went for a white walk in the woods this morning and ran into bear droppings.
Yeah.
So. Okay. But I didn't run into any bears.
Yeah.
They are well.
Bear Fort, Bear Den, that's what they mean by the island, yeah. Eh?
And everybody calls in here, if we go someplace, we go to Jono or Sitka, Hoot, Bear, House, Tribe. They all call us Bear Tribe, but we all different tribe over here.
You, Mrs. George, when she spoke earlier today, referred to the fact you have more than one tribe on this island. She mentioned the bear and the raven and the beaver and the eagle and so on. Are those tribes or clans, or does that distinction mean anything?
It means there were nations once. Nation with governments of their own.
There's no, I don't think it's any separation about this land. In the olden days, it's all in one. The money, seven tribes in here in this small village, they're all in claim. Everybody owns it. Yeah. I'm sorry too with it that on the other governor. Governor Eagle, he got the money for us, the older people. Governor Parks never did nothing to us. He come over here.
Can you let me have a copy of that?
He come to over here. How much land China on the net? He's supposed to be a chief in here. We don't call no chief anybody, any place. Big man. That's what they would call the owner of the house, the tribe house. Big man. He's the one, ask him, how much land you're going to give us? He just point out this way, that much. We don't know where it is. It's still today like that. We went to Juno about this thing. Everything was against us anyway. But now that people that don't help at all, that's the one that's in office over here. And we did get nothing.
What office is that?
See, Alaska and all the corporations is talking about people.
No. I wish they offered about $600 apiece every month. We could have been satisfied with it. But they take it all. And that's the way I know. That's all I know about this thing. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, sir. I'm really glad we came up here. The record should show that we have taken the evidence
okay.
of Mr. Jimmy George in the home of in the George home here in Angoon in their family residence, and we're grateful to Mr. and Mrs. George for inviting us over here to take Mr. George's evidence.
Now, these are the These are the Tlingit place names we're talking about, the tribal groups. I call them tribe because they were governing themselves in their home areas. That's the Kulawil, Tequated, that's the Brown Bear tribe, which Kitan, that's what Jim Sr. was. He uses the emblem of wolf or eagle, Kagwantan. These people, like I said, now the raven side, the Shitan, that's raven, the beaver, dog salmon. And we have Tachdentan. These people originate from Huna and they're living with us, original villages of the tribes differently.
Mm-hmm.
I took this from the elderly. I've mentioned they're gone now. Now these are the place names of Hutbi area. It starts from that. That was their historical village, the Kilwell historical village. That's a doggone new a fort there. All this and Hutbi area, Tanchushir. The fish jumps here so much that people can't sleep. That's the way it is. The point there. These are all in Tlingit. I'm sorry I didn't put the English names there, but I couldn't do a shorthand. I could.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to school with, there were English girls here who were writing the alphabet for our Tlingit language. That's why I was able to put down what their elderly was saying. Place names of Jiyik area. Chikayanu, that's where his dad had a tribal house and everything. Then these were the Kilauea territory, and it tells you the date that we put it together. Not only one or two, but a house full of elderly people. Five would have to maybe identical history before I make sure.
Mm-hmm.
This was for the land sue and for the land claims. This was record.
This is to prove use and occupation of tribal territory.
Yes, and we covered the whole island. Now this is the area that the fight is about, Kub Kof.
Mm-hmm.
These are statements made by elderly people. Oh. My children was able to help me type up the things. Oh. My son Gabby, the one you met, and a sister who lives now in Sitka, that's the children I'm talking about, that I willed my stock to her children. Now, they're born in Sitka, growing up in Sitka, and their ideals is different from my husband and mine.
Thank you.
And that's a little bit of the Angoon history. That's just where all the things...
Well, thank you, Mrs. George. These documents will all be part of the formal... record, the permanent record of the commission, and I'll make sure that they're filed and copied and sent to the University of Alaska along with the transcript.
It is a prize what I have. one of the elderly from Huna.
I don't know if my spelling is right here.
Mr. George has handed me a note from his notebook, which says in the late 1930s, the ANB attempted to designate itself as the Central Council, but was restrained from doing so by the Department of the Interior because the membership of the ANB was not limited to Tlingit and Haida Indians. This is apparently on the advice of Undersecretary of Interior John A. Carver, Jr. In Sitka, one of the elders told us about that and said that that led to the formation of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council to represent the Tlingit and Haida. So yes, thank you, sir.
When it was formed, I was one of the representatives, yeah. But he was the president. Our meetings was run in the Tlingit language, but we used the Robert Rules of Order. Mm-hmm. This is another place names that's inside this Hutsnu inlet up inside the bay, like Kanaga Bay, Wankaki, that's favorite bay, Hunye'a, that's Salt Lake up in there, Hunye, that's Mitchell Bay, and that Kanatakati, that's Blueberry Island, E.K., Big Lake. Just the way it looked, the name was that description of what it looked like to them. Look on it, the Koho village, that's where the Koho, the stream is. Sha'iye, woman's lake. Chatkuo, halibut tail. Kak'iye, crab apple island, that's what it is. Heat the back of a killer whale. Nuskinakat, that Treeman Island, that's a hill. Looked like three men were standing. In back of it, we used to pick blueberries.
Well, thanks very much. Well, I sure appreciate your inviting us over, Mrs. George.
Land is the issue. Land. Get some of the land back for our people, I was told. For people to build homes on, our children, for our grandchildren to have homes built on that land, to subsist off. It'd be better than all the money you can get. Okay. That was the advice given to me by the elders.
And I take it that's your advice today, too.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you for coming up.
Well, my pleasure.
Thank you.
What little I could help, I'm not an official representative, but I still do help the elderly. And this is my auntie, Mrs. Mary Willis.
How do you do, ma'am?
She came to show me some information that's on the paper about what Shattuck's doing.
Oh, yeah, that's in the... Well, we read about that. Thank you.
See, that woman, that Ethel Stanton, she's of the Killerwell tribe, but she's a Tsimshian Indian. So what happens 1991, the corporation, if everybody sells their stock over in Sitka, what happens to then their corporation, the logging that's going to be making a village on the island? This is why we're fighting them.
Excuse me. Up the bay in Hout Bay, there's a fall in there. Put the toast to the salt water. They were used to come, it was full all the time, the fish right there. Logging camp. Put up a camp over there and work over there. And the oil comes out and the dirt, everything. Today, nothing in there. many years ago now, there's no fish comes in there. That's why I said to some of the people when I said, keep away from this Mitchell Bay and Kanaka Bay, that is Rakai Creeks. To keep away from this, don't fall anything closer. I want that, I'm old, I'll be gone anytime. But the kids is coming up, small kids. I want them to have it. That's the way I talk all the time.
Well, thanks very much, sir. I don't think you're going anytime. I think you're going to be here next time we come.
Well, okay. Thank you for coming up.
Okay, well, bye-bye then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please, your name?
My name is Martha M. Jack, maiden name Itta, and am an Inupiat Eskimo from Barrow. Age 32, and I have resided in Angoon for the past 8.5 years. A few years ago, my husband and I were approached by the Juno KTO program personnel while shopping in a mall and with their camera and microphone on a hand to ask us on the spot what our thoughts were on Angska. After asking what and why they were asking this for, they asked, you are a Native Corporation shareholder, aren't you? And after being assured that this filming would not be unjustly used, we proceeded. I, as myself and personal feelings, stated that it was not benefiting us Alaskans as it was proposed to be. Angska has divided up the Alaska Natives into groups and own corporations. About land, I asked, where is my land when before there were no restrictions? Angska has divided the Natives and also restricted the use of their land. I ended with a statement that I was sorry Angska ever came to be. My feelings towards Angska are that it has changed our native lifestyle and has put so many restrictions in it that it's gotten to where an Alaska Native does not know anymore where to go and what to do when before it came about we had a natural lifestyle. Now there are so many federal and state restrictions imposed upon us that it could make any concerned Native cry or just give up or be plain mad. Angoon has reminded me constantly of how Barrow used to be before big companies and the corporations came into place. I think highly of Angoon because the people have kept on in their natural lifestyle, defying what is going on in the world of corporations and business. I wish that it had been kept like this in Barrow, and I know that the natives in Barrow feel that way too. We as natives were to me suddenly overtaken. I know that during my last few years in schooling, it was stressed that we were going to determine an aid in how Alaska was going to become. I realize that there have been a lot of discrepancies in the management and administration of the Angska Act, and now it is hitting us at our own homes. But why have I been led up to the fact that first, this land will be ours forever, no matter what a corporation does. Second, that I wasn't fairly familiarized to the Act when it concerned my well-being. Third, what are the rights of us as shareholders to our corporation? Fourth, why are the corporations being so quiet about our land? When I was growing up, there were no restrictions as to the use of our daily diet and land use. I treasure those days as I was growing up because they were my true native lifestyle. I wish my children could have gone to see could have gotten to see those days as my husband and I remember each of our own. The change of life began rapidly for the natives, and some, like my close relatives, were caught in the middle because they were so used to the native way of life. And when Western culture came around, they were found ineligible to do this or that. Hunting and fishing grounds started being restricted, and it was like the natives were tacked onto a wall of rules and regulations. I greatly admire Sadie Nekok of Barrow when she used to be the magistrate when she let the natives to get their right back from fish and game to keep their hunting rights and won. The natives have been so undermined right here in our own land that it could make anyone just want to give up and go to rot. I am glad that the native cultures of each organized corporation shareholder have not changed and still have the opportunity to speak. Another problem with ANGSCA is that even though the community of Angoon and the community of Barrow are under the same act, where and how are the natives divided? I asked some time before if I could change my shares to this divisional corporation since all my kids were brought up here and I intend to stay here. The answer was no. The question comes up, why were my rights and responsibilities held away from me when the shareholders were being counted? And why was I not given the Claims Act along with my certificate? I find myself feeling dumb about the whole ANGSCA Act and feel deprived for not having been adequately informed. This is just like how the system of the federal government works, that after the fact is made known. I am thankful that my opinion has been let out, and also am hurt that us natives have been greatly undermined and made to feel useless. I only hope now that these corporation personnel and directors follow the thoughts and feelings of these testimonies. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I think that it was altogether fitting that we should hear your testimony at this time, Ms. Jack, and I think we've had a good visit here in Angoon, and I think that we will now adjourn the hearings in Angoon, it being 5:10 on Sunday, and I know all of you will be going to church. So thank you, Mrs. Jack, and thank you all.
The Claim Settlement Act, and some of the things that has accrued from it. And to start out in a positive sense, I guess, certainly if Western man and wanted to assimilate, you know, Alaska Natives or Natives in general into Western culture, that's one heck of a, assimilate. That's one heck of a way to do it. And it's, you know, very effective because it gave a lot of Alaska Natives a power base, meaning money and land and the resources on that land to harvest and sell and participate in the commercialization of our resources, which has occurred throughout since Western man has arrived. So it certainly put them in an equal footing, because I don't know how to look at that in terms of the world market or national market in terms of the resources. But before land claims and before Alaska Natives were able to, and indeed many of them weren't able to participate in, you know, in the commercialization of the resources other than salmon. And salmon was, you know, lucrative. I mean, there was a lot of salmon that were certainly harvested by Alaska Natives and Western men. But basically, you know, the main thrust of what has occurred is, you know, has put many Alaska Natives in relatively powerful positions, and positions that everyone had to recognize because of their land base, because of their resource, you know, commercialization of resources and all. Yeah, those are just a little bit my notes, sir.
No, I just thought he's going to write all. He wants something under that to the table top.
Yeah, you're certainly welcome to use that.
Sorry, go ahead.
So, you know, it put natives in a leadership role, and also a role model for other natives in Alaska. Because basically, I think, not only in terms of local area, but in the state scene and in the national scene, Alaska Native or American Natives were basically in a pretty much a no-win situation. They're, if you look at the rest of the natives in America, at least in my mind, basically if they're on reservations, where they have land, they have resources, but pretty much, at least unless I'm really misinformed, a lot of those resources were managed by someone else. And most of the monies that have occurred up until recently that, you know, derived from those resources have gone to other people. For instance, in Washington, many of the ranches and cattle ranches and all were once owned and now are used by Westerners, non-natives, and they make the profits. They make all the, you know, profits from the land. And I've met many of them. And for the most part, the Native Americans did without. They had, because a lot of, you know, the lands were in trust, because they didn't own them, because they didn't have the power to, you know, to either sell or use it as collateral, would they have? Not very much in my mind, unless they're able to retain some of those lands. And, you know, some of the things I'm going to be talking about may not be exactly true throughout the, you know, U.S., but at least from the part that I did see, it seemed pretty much true. Certainly there were some, you know, like the Navajos and all have seen fit to, you know, to manage their own lands and do a lot more than other Native Americans. But back to Alaska, I think that, you know, like I said, I'm talking on the positive side first, that it put Native Alaskans in a very powerful position, so that many of them are on boards, many of them on commissions, and then, you know, not only on their own right, but because there is a land base and a power base and an economic power base that they're dealing from. And so they have to be reckoned with. No longer can you just, you know, slip to the side and say, well, you know, we'll have a token native here and there. They are sitting at the same table making decisions that may be positive or negative, but they're making decisions along with a lot of other people in Alaska. There must be more positive things than that. Yeah, it also, of course, extended further out than Alaska and the U.S., and that many of the Alaska Natives are going overseas or dwelling in the international marketplace in terms of the resources, and therefore have, more than just a position in Alaska or in the U.S., but are dealing with the international markets, and I guess that's, big time. So that with these role models and, you know, with the positions that Alaska Natives now have, I think more Alaska Natives will eventually become more assimilated and pretty much make a mark in the world and be looked at themselves and their people in a more positive manner, along with more Alaskan Natives looking at themselves as something other than losers. I think there was a serious and self-image that many Alaska Natives and Native Americans in general looked at themselves in the past in a more negative manner because they didn't have anything. They didn't have land base, didn't have power base, didn't have economic base, didn't have much of a standing in the world that we live in. And it's reflected in a high suicide rate in, America-wide. I don't know if this land claims will, affect that immediately in terms of, that we'll no longer have the high suicide rate or any other things, negative things that are generally associated with Alaska Natives, but it certainly will have an effect on how they view themselves and that they will no longer be insignificant or losers or tokens, and that they will have some role model to look at. They'll have some people who will have made it financially and like Byron Malotz, like Al Kukashis, like many of our Alaskan Native leaders. I mean, they're on the forefront.
What's the spelling? No. What's the spelling of the name you gave? You mentioned Byron Malotte, and who is the?
Al Kukash, and there's a guy up in. There's a lot. There's a lot of Alaskan Natives that have made it into very. Leader, high, powerful leadership roles on the local level, on the Alaska level, on the national level. Certainly, John Borbridge, who was one of the first that started off in Alaska and came out to villages and listened to the people, made it in Alaska level, made it with Sea Alaska, made it on a national level, and was an ambassador for the president. So that hasn't happened in the past, as far as I know. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I don't know that much, but at least in my mind, there isn't too many people who have done that. although, there are a lot more Alaska Natives that have made it in the academic world and professional world and have become lawyers and all that. But certainly not at the level where ANSCA or Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act has placed them. And it's more than just an individual accomplishment and make it in the academic and professional world. It also backs them up with a very powerful land base and resource base. And to me, that's all, I may have left out a lot of things that I've thought about in the past in terms of positive things that has happened with ANSCA, On a negative side, it's created a lot of conflict within rural or native lives. And in terms of the land, a lot of people are concerned about the land, and justifiably so. I imagine you've heard a lot of testimony on 1991 and losing the land and losing the stock and losing a lot of power that has come from having those, having that land base, having a resource base, and having a place in Alaska. And, so their concerns are, I think, in my mind, justified. but along with that, along with losing that, or along with having those that land base, that power base, and all, if you didn't have, if it was all in trust, if it was all in IRAs, then what would we have? We'd have, in essence, reservations, and who would, have power in those reservations? It would be, U.S. government in terms of trust, unless there was a lot of, unless there were some provisions, you know, there's certainly things that I think that government and IRAs can do that can give IRAs some power, you know. But I don't know if it would be as powerful as the profit-making corporations. Along with power, of course, there's risk, and along with risk, the risk of losing land and power base certainly exists. So I, you know, only time will tell whether profit-making corporations was indeed a positive one for Alaskan as a whole, or at, you know, in terms of the financial or for the power base, or in terms of the role models and the lives of the children's after, or your grandchildren and all after that. But certainly, at least in my mind, that the profit-making corporation, the land base and all, has put values that are, have been very strongly felt by the elders and for and by many Alaska Natives and other Native people, as that that we don't own the land. Now we're forced to own the land. So it's a conflict internally, externally, and I don't know how else to put it, in spiritually, in terms of the Alaska Natives. I don't know if there is any specific way to have it resolved. Certainly, looking at IRAs and trying to put it, you know, I mean, certainly, I don't think we should put the everything on a line in terms of our lands and resources. So, question comes up as to, well, how much should we put on a line so that we can maintain our land base, our power base, our economic power base, our political power base, and how much should we put into IRAs? Certainly not all of it. You know, certainly in order to have and maintain role models and quote and unquote successful and people who fail in our political arena and economic arena, that has to be maintained. In terms of our, the kids that haven't made it in the stocks and being part of the corporations, I don't know how they can resolve that. I really don't. I don't know if it should occur or shouldn't occur. I know that many of the elders in the communities and other communities look at their children and their grandchildren, and it's a very positive outlook on life in terms of trying to maintain a secure world for your grandchildren and their grandchildren. I don't know how it fits in with profit-making corporations, other than saying that that maybe there's something that more that you have to look at in terms of land and the resources. Not saying that they're not important, because I certainly respect and am proud of being from Angoon and seeing that they maintain the environment around Angoon in terms of the resources that they can obtain from it now and in the future, and protecting that land. And they've done it at extreme cost. I mean, I can't imagine how much it costs to fight the U.S. government, to fight private industry, to fight other Native corporations to maintain the island. But they've done it. And they've done it, you know, somewhat unitedly. Certainly there's always the minority. I mean, not everyone thinks in terms of extremes 100%, but a majority, more than a majority of the people in Angoon have fought against logging. Not to say that, you know, that logging is all wrong or all right, but certainly around Admiralty, and because the land has always provided deer and salmon and all, for the people. That's one sure thing to count on. Jobs come and go. Certainly corporations will rise and fall. You know. We're fortunate that Sea Alaska is probably one of the bigger and more economically safe, or I guess somewhat corporation, because of the land and, or the trees, timber on the land. It's unfortunate that all of Alaska didn't have, you know, as rich of an area as Sea Alaska has in terms of timber and minerals that are located in this land. But let's see. Well, in terms of the negative, and I assume that it existed before Alaska Plains and all, but I assume that anywhere there is large amounts of money, there is somebody who's willing to take high risk in terms of getting more money, whether it be legitimate or not. But there's always those few people that will make a lot of money when the opportunity arises, whether that's legal or illegal. It's a matter of, I imagine, a court decision, whatever. I'm sure some illegal things that go on, courts will not find as being illegal, but they certainly are illegal in terms of moral sense, or, you know. But technically or legally, I imagine the courts aren't all fail safe and all. So nonetheless, you know, I think that that's gone on in the past, and I assume it's going on now, and probably it'll go on in the future in terms of our native leaders and non-native leaders. It's unfortunate, but I think that's something that has occurred throughout time in terms of commercialization and resource, which brings in a lot of money and a lot of potential opportunities for people to do something in that. Let's see. Certainly the negative aspect of 1991 is probably you've probably heard all the reasons, you know, about 1991 and negative things associated with it.
What do you think about it?
I think there's too much well, I don't know. I certainly heard a lot of arguments, you know, and concerns about 1991 and losing the land, losing the resources, and losing corporations, whether it be by shares or by being taxed out of business. And certainly that was probably in the design of it. I mean, there's certainly a way to bring a hell of a lot of land and a lot of resources and a lot of money, put it on the open market, and certainly somebody's going to be in there, you know, waiting and able to take over those corporations and make a lot of money. I think that I don't know whether our children will lose more or by being thrown into the modern world and by their parents, you know, making it or losing it in today's world. Certainly you'll have people, you know, the people who have, you know, politically strong families and all, their children probably make it. Certainly is reflected in the number of people like from Juneau who go on to college and make it in today's world. They're associated or are around and recognize and see people who make it in today's world and what you know, what you have to do to make it in there. And that closeness, I assume, you know, provides a lot of incentive for the kids to go ahead and make it. 1991 may or may not have, I mean, we may have half of, or I would I have no idea what percentage it would be. Certainly not all the corporations will make it. And certainly a lot will fail or fall and get up, and some may not have an opportunity to get back up. Depends upon their resources on their lands. For the ones that don't make it, I think that'll probably pretty much do away with anything the kids had in terms of having role models and having, you know, something to strive towards. For those that are fortunate to have some corporation, regional corporation like Sea Alaska, and they have role models that are, you know, in terms of their parents or uncles or whoever, recognize, you know, that there's Alaska natives that have made it, will certainly have one of the best opportunities in the world to make it in today's world. I don't know. I haven't thought, you know, it throughout. I just sort of looked at what's happened so far, and a lot of the things that are going to happen in the future, or, you know, I can't predict. I can certainly see some possibilities.
Can you just?
So you're wondering where you went?
Can you tell me a little bit, just for the record, about yourself, Mr. George? You were born and raised here in Angoon, were you?
Yeah, I was born in the house I'm living in, which is Kidu Kohit, which is Killwhale Tooth House, which is my dad's tribal house. Generally, when I get up in front of hearings, public hearings like this, or Forest Service, or Corps of Engineers, I generally say, my name's Doc Dinam Deshitan from Angoon, which pretty much places me with who I am and a little bit about my background. My dad's 94. He's one of the oldest Killwhales left alive in Southeast. His name is Wuchkudaha. He's Dakuwedi from Hood Bay, and has lived in Angoon for, you know, most all his life. I was born and spent the first part of my life in Angoon, and my folks moved to Sitka on a fishing trip, a 2-week fishing trip, which lasted 10 years. But my dad's thought that perhaps his children ought to get a better education than what was offered in Angoon at the time, and so moved to Sitka and gave up his fishing life and all to become a janitor, to, you know, in order for his kids to go to school. And for the most part, I'd say it worked. That I have a sister who was, you know, practicing at nursing, and another sister who was secretary to a lawyer and secretary to a principal, and also they've gone out and held down relatively secure and exciting jobs. And I've taught at Sheldon Jackson, and worked for Forest Service. I usually say service. Now working for Fish and Game.
Alaska State Department of Fish and Game.
Right.
In a particular division?
Yeah, subsistence division. Matt Kukash and I work together in Angoon. We're the only field office that is comprised of 100% Alaska natives.
That's the office here in Angoon?
Right, yeah.
And two out of two?
Two out of two. Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to... How big is your district here?
Well, generally, there's 3.5...
Excuse me, are we going to get this?
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
Okay.
There's
he just moved back on the piano there.
Oh, okay. I see a light still going back and forth. Yeah.
Okay.
There's 3.5 of us working in Southeast. There's Matt Kukash, Dave Mills, and his tech, who's on half-time. And southeast extends from Yakutat down to Ketchikan, or included all of the area south of Yakutat. So it's a relatively large chunk of territory, and there's a lot of information that we don't have on subsistence use of the resources. And so our job is we're quite busy.
Are you trying to collect information on subsistence use of renewable resources? Or is your job enforcement, or could you tell me a bit about that?
Well, the Subsistence Division, of course, was created out of Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. It was to give subsistence users, whether native or non-native in Alaska, I don't know if I should say this officially or not, because I'm that high up on the ladder. So unofficially, this is the way I see it. The Subsistence Division was created to obtain information on subsistence use of the resources in Alaska. Given that the subsistence priority law came into effect in terms of the U.S. government and the state of Alaska, only when the resources were in such a state that you had to cut back on some of the effort on those resources. And that's only the time the subsistence priority law comes into effect, is that you have to cut back on the commercial and sports and recreational use of those resources before you cut back on the subsistence use. Therefore, it's sort of a quasi-priority. I mean, you know, it's a use that exists, and if the resource becomes endangered, then you cut back on all the other uses first. You can still, after you cut back on those other uses, can cut back on the subsistence use of the resource. Unfortunately, in Alaska, and I assume in many other areas of the world, that where commercialization of the resource and sport use of the resource, that the information is not available in terms of subsistence use of the resources. And that is true in Alaska. We still don't know, you know, a lot about how much is taken in subsistence use, whether it be fish or game or waterfowl or marine mammals. There's a lot that we don't know, but that's no biggie, because there's a lot we don't know anyway. But unfortunately, uses of the resources generally, at least in my mind, always connected with commercialization of the resource. If the federal government, state government is going to obtain some monies from, or it's going to provide some jobs for, or somewhat connected to monetary, then there's studies that are carried out. Then there's, you know, management schemes and all. So generally, and it's not always true, that we know a lot about the resources that are commercially taken, and who's taken them, how much you're taken, and supposedly what the biological sustained yield would be if it's a renewable resource, and if it isn't, how long it will last if it's a non-renewable resource. That's kind of a long statement about what Subsistence Division does, but basically we go out and talk to people, much like you're doing, with a questionnaire, with a survey instrument and in-depth interviews.
I was just reading a report issued about a year ago by the Sierra Club to its members. This was put in evidence by a witness at Sitka the other night. In it, the Sierra Club describes the people of Angoon as the last true subsistence community of the Tlingit in southeast Alaska. And it then, in what I think is clearly exaggerated language, goes on to say that if Cube Cove is logged, that'll be the end of the Tlingit in southeast Alaska. But leaving aside the hyperbole, What about their statement that the people here in Angoon, the Tlingits here in Angoon, are to a greater extent than any community of Tlingits anywhere in Southeast Alaska engaged in subsistence? So.
Is that just my own personal?
Yes.
Okay.
Just what any observations.
Professional. I don't want to have stated that Subsistence Division employees states that yes, Angoon is or Angoon isn't. Certainly, you know, Kwakwan up north of Haines is a subsistence community. They're not as remote, I guess. But Angoon isn't that remote either. Certainly you can fly in out any day of the week almost, or get on a ferry or whatever and get out. I think that for the most part, Angoon is looked at as a subsistence community because of the stand they've taken. And it isn't all in terms of subsistence.
The stand on Cube Cove.
The stand on Admiralty Island and their lands, that they, you know, that's the only thing that's safe in the minds of Tlingit. And I've learned that, I think I learned a heck of a lot.
Tanar, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you were about to make some observations on... On Angoon, Admiralty Island.
Yeah.
So. Subsistence in Southeast. Yeah.
Well, I haven't only been up in Haines and Kwakwan and Sitka and Cake and Hunan and Angoon. Angoon and Kwakwan are relatively the same, you know, in terms of the amount of reliance on the resources or subsistence community. I think that what stands out in Angoon is that many of the elders before JOM, which is Johnson O'Malley Program, and others, that many elders, not many I should say, some of the elders taught some of the young people the Tlingit way in Angoon, taught them the dances, taught them the songs, taught them some of the Tlingit values, and that was going on, you know, before it was going on in Sitka and other communities. Consequently, the young people in Angoon, when they accompanied the elders out to various communities and participated in Indian doings, whether it be a memorial party or payoff party or whatever for someone in another community, it was certainly seen that, you know, that Tlingit culture was strong and alive in Angoon. And that's, you know, to the benefit of our elders and the time that some of the younger people gave to listening to their elders. So with that Tlingit culture being so much strong, one associates that with you know, the subsistence use of resources and subsistence community and all. So I think that's where a lot of it comes from. And Angoon's well known as a stronghold of Tlingit culture. And that's not to say that anyone else in Southeast doesn't have a strong handle on their Tlingit culture. But certainly there are many elders in Southeast and many who know about Tlingit culture and have seen fit to relay some of that information to their young, the people in their community. And that's not to say that everything's, you know, hunky-dory, rosy, or whatever. Everything's going great in Angoon or any place else. But that's how people see Angoon, I think. Consequently, I think that's where.
What about Huna, Cake, Tenaki? People there engaged in subsistence?
You know, people in Cake and Huna do go out and, you know, gather resources and, you know, or use the resource in non-commercially, and also participate in commercial use, whether it be salmon or harvesting timber. The unfortunate thing, at least in my mind, and it goes back to the Claims Act and profit-making corporations and where the timber is situated, for the most part, as I understand it, and and it's only my understanding, because I haven't read an elk all that much, even though I've worked with the Forest Service and Fish and Game, but the lands that were given to village corporations were immediately around their community, sort of mandated. And that does a couple of things. It, of course, provides an economic base, provides employment and everything right there in the community where young people and old people and, where people can sit back and physically see something happening and see the money that comes from the project. Unfortunately, it also somewhat destroys deer habitats and habitat and a few other things. But and therefore, they have to extend the range and obtaining the resources from other places. Where Angoon is fortunate is that we had some leaders that saw a little bit further in the future, and were able to listen to the elders who said, no, we don't want to harvest around Angoon. And this happened, of course, before land claims. Because there was a champion pie with it wanted to come in and harvest timber around the Angoon area. As a matter of fact, half of Admiralty Island. And there's a survey done, and in that survey they asked people in Angoon, residents in Angoon, if they'd be willing to be employed by a logging company if one came around Angoon. Over 75% of them said no. That's significant. That says something about the values that are associated with people in Angoon. And so I'm glad that, and happy and everything, that the corporation in Angoon saw fit to move off the island and lobby and still be part of the land claims, part of the profit-making corporation. But
you mean
still,
Kutsunahoo?
Yeah, Kutsunahoo. But still maintain the island in its natural state and still maintain the streams, and they're very conservative people. My background is basically in fisheries. I got a marine biology background and was in a master's program in fisheries at Humboldt and taught in the natural resources program at Humboldt and at Sheldon Jackson. And so I thought I knew a little bit about salmon fisheries, and when they came over to Angoon under Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, which is a regional association of nonprofit hatchery corporation, and said you'd like to help you put in a fish hatchery, you would think, because the people in Angoon derived both commercially and for subsistence use from salmon, that they'd be more than willing and happy to say yes. When in actuality, what they said was no. They said,
that sounds like a philosophical discussion.
Took
to me,
thousands of years for, they said they took thousands of years for the salmon to adapt to coming into this area, and we don't want you to screw it up. And so, like the comment said,